This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Even if you don't know anything at all about the guitarist Kaki King as a listener to public radio, you might well recognise this tune, which All Things Considered used between stories for at least a year, a couple of years ago. Rolling Stone magazine called Kaki King, quote, a genre unto herself. Widely considered one of the best players of her generation, Kaki King is as much a technician as she is a player. She recently performed a virtual solo show in a hall at Georgia Tech, in which she used a guitar she designed to be both an instrument and a video screen. Using projection mapping software, she projects images related to the music, either literally or figuratively, on the body of the guitar as she plays. She's also designed, together with a luthier, a wooden arch-shaped bridge that fits beneath the strings of the guitar, turning it into a kind of harp and allowing the player to create sounds unlike anything previously produced on a guitar. Kaki King grew up in Atlanta. Today she lives in Brooklyn with her wife and her two children. I talked to her on the phone from her home. Interestingly, while her first instrument was the guitar, her first public experience as a musician was as a drummer in the school band when she was in fourth grade.
I had already been playing guitar, but they didn't have any place for that. So the band director said, well, you know, guitar's a rhythm instrument anyway, basically, in his opinion. And so why doesn't she, you know, she should just play drums because she's already doing rhythmic stuff. So at age 9 in fourth grade, I started playing drum set and snare drum and marimba and you know, more classical percussion. And that is the bulk of my musical education actually came through percussion because I played all the way through high school band. And so even while my guitar world was taking off, if it was charting its own course, I was learning a lot of traditional fundamentals in the percussion world, excuse me.
I mean, what could be better in fourth grade than they tell you, you can bang on this, you know? Oh, and you can bang on this one too. Make as much noise as you like, you know?
The problem is that is not what they... In fact, I think band directors probably spend 90% of their energy hushing up the drummers in the back because we're in the back of the room. We have plenty of stuff to bang on. We can't. And we just sit there twirling our sticks and dropping them. I mean, I became an absurdly good stick twirler dropper as well. So it's almost like a repressed energy that comes out when you can finally do that cymbal crash at the end of a song.
And so you had all this grounding in percussion. You'd already been playing the guitar. Mm-hmm. So how did the two come together? Because clearly, it seems to me clearly they did.
You know, it's funny. They in my playing and my writing, there's a superficial version where it's very obvious, where I'm, you know, hitting the guitar or keeping a backbeat or otherwise sort of, you know, giving a percussive sound. And that's one element. The other element that I think is more true to form as a drummer is that one hand will be doing something independent of the other. So when you learn to play guitar, you squeeze a note down on the fretboard with your left hand and you pluck with your right. And those two, the combination of those two actions makes a note. Well, I was already, you know, hammering and pulling off with my left hand and finger picking with my right. And those were often, you know, they were separate. They were together. They were independent. They kind of, one day, you know, I might have pulled off a note with my left hand that a measure later I actually stopped with my right. You know, there's a lot happening where given the independence of the limbs as a drummer that I learned was very important in my guitar playing and composing.
I'm not a musician, so I'm not sure if this is even true, but it seems to me that because you approach it, at least in part, in a percussive way, you get these multiple layers going in your music. That seems to me that's more of a percussion thing than it is a melodic thing, you know?
Well, you know, it's one thing to... I mean, I think music is not melody. Music is harmony. So it's melody plus, right? Or you know, bass line plus. I mean, I think that's where the emotion... You know, melodies rarely kind of carry a certain gravitas until you add a harmony to them. So, and you can do that... Again, you can do that independently in terms of, you know, the left hand is sort of operating on its own, or the right hand, or you can do it together. I think the interesting thing about being young and playing fingerstyle guitar is this: it's almost like there's a beauty to it, and there's a, you know, a great, clearly there's a lot of care through coming through that music, but there is a bit of, you know, what can I pull off, and you know, how can I use the tools that I have to, you know, to be as big as I can be by myself. And I, you know, whether I knew it or not, I adhered to that idea for the first couple of albums that I did because I felt strongly that it was important that I could fill up all of this sound with, you know, it just being me. And then I realized that I was adhering to something that was far too dogmatic and strict, and I moved on. But there is a kind of discipline to it. And I think my playing as a solo musician, especially live, I will always be at my best when it's just me with a guitar on stage, you know, that's sort of at my highest degree of concentration, discipline, practicing, you know, all of those things that have come together to make me who I am as a musician.
And yet, the discipline comes in the prep. When you actually come to play, that discipline becomes sort of sublimated, right? And you're freed.
Yeah.
Because there's a great deal of freedom in your playing, while at the same time, the discipline is apparent. It's a bit like flamenco. Is flamenco something you listen to much?
I do, and I grew up listening to Segovia and a lot of the, you know, the Spanish classical greats, and then sort of discovered flamenco as like a, I kind of thought it was punk classical.
And, yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
You know, it's like kind of, you know, adhering to the rules and the nope, and just going off and just the intensity and beauty of it was always very appealing to me. But I think that's what we all miss, right? Is that you can't, you know, I could train myself to get up every night and play a song the exact same way with that level of precision, but it does lose the reason why we would ever go see a live concert. The element of improvisation or, you know, falling off the cliff or holding back or, you know, changing the way I would play a song slightly or greatly, you know, all these choices that I get to make that give someone a unique performance that will never be repeated. Haven't done that in a minute, but...
Well, it seems to me that what you're describing is that thing I guess we call performance, right? Where you go, and maybe it's a male thing, you know, this thing that, man, that technique is awesome, and it's always been on my part. The feeling's always been, yeah, but you know, music is about making a connection,
yeah.
Right? Music is about making a connection, and it seems to me that that's more interesting to you than, you know, having people,
so,
you know, oohing and aahing over your technique.
But listen, the problem with it all is that, you know, technique is just, it's just a learnable skill, right?
Mm.
It really, I think that if you have a good teacher or a good set of, you know, guidelines, and it's something that most people, if they go down a path, can master. And writing is not. And so that's why I take composition really, really, really seriously, and technique can only be a means to an end. Because, you know, the songs that I have written, really, if you look at my any kind of stat ever from day one, from the first record I put out, it was always the slow song, the meditative one, the one that, you know, was subtle, that had nothing to do with the current, you know, kind of crazy tapping and wild playing that, you know, for instance, got me on television. All of the retention I've had from a fan base has come from those beautiful songs. And I am very aware of that. And I think that is, you know, I think that's what, you know, it's really, really easy, frankly, to write a song using extended technique. It is very difficult to write a song that people want to get married to or want to give birth to or want to, you know, gets them through grad school or they listen to in rehab. I mean, those are the things that people tell me their music does for me, and it's never the song with the tappity tap. So that's why I feel like my obligation is to write as best as I can using whatever tools I have.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I guess all music making is trying to find that place where heart and head meet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there's so much heart in what you do. On Scenic Roots, this is Talking Writing. My guest is Kaki King. I mentioned in the introduction among the innovations that Kaki King has introduced to the guitar is something called a passerelle, which is made of wood and looks like a classic bridge, a literal arch that sits under the strings of the guitar. This is a track from her most recent album, Modern Yesterdays, on which she uses a passerelle. It's called Teak. Seems to me that you're always pushing your technique too. Take the use of the passerelle as an example of that. I watched you play it in the video, And it's really cool to watch it because it's almost like, you know, watching a guitarist's right hand twice. Your left hand's doing essentially the same thing your right hand's doing.
Exactly. And then also, but then you know, one hand is plucking, the other hand is bending, which neither hand has any idea how to do. And so, yeah, it's a, but you're right. It's funny because when I tell people about it, I say, you know, your right hand is pretty much already there. The left hand has got to change entirely. And the more you can make your left hand like the right hand, the better you will. But it is a very awkward change suddenly. I think probably my experience playing lap steel, you know, with a guitar on my lap and using a bar instead of any kind of fretting was helpful when starting off playing Sassoon.
At the same time, is your training as a drummer have anything to do with that? Because it just amazes me that a drummer can do four things at once, two feet and two hands, all doing something different, you know?
Well, you know, when you say different, though, it's still in context, right? There's still a beat. There's people that can, you know, drummers that can go way out of town and be playing in, you know, in divisions of five on a hi-hat. Well, I mean, there's some technical players out there that really are quite interesting. But still, there is a framework. It's not like, you know, one hand is cooking an egg and the other hand is typing an email. I mean, that would be, although that, I would watch that show. So I think with Passerelle, that my left hand is already used to doing something completely independent. So it doesn't have to pay attention. It doesn't have to be in sync with the right hand. And therefore, even though the Passerelle only has 12 notes, I can make the most of those notes.
Yeah, no doubt. So how do you do two things at once like that? It's a bit like, you know, patting your head and rubbing your belly kind of thing, right?
Well, but yeah, patting your head and rubbing your belly, sure. But imagine doing it in rhythm. It's a much different scenario. You know, imagine everything having to, you know, come together on the one or come together every four bars. To, you know, it's always, you know, I like to remind people it's not as complex as truly doing something completely, you know, like your brain has to really think on four different levels.
Yeah. So what I'm getting then is that the what you're creating with one hand is a complement to what you're doing with the other hand.
Precisely.
Yeah. And added to which, you know, the Passerelle, you know, a number of people have compared the sound to a koto, but it sounds to my as much like a harp, a Western harp, as it does a koto.
There you go. Yeah. I think the ability to bend the string is what kind of gives it that koto sound. But yeah, it is really a harp because so many of, you know, all the strings are vibrating through that bridge and therefore kind of giving off this, you know, blended sound of the strings ringing just ever so slightly.
And again, the result is this kind of multi-layered. It's very trippy, actually. It's very floaty. You know, what you said about the music being whatever somebody wants to take from it on a given day in a given mood.
Yeah.
It's kind of a blank slate in that sense. You can project on it whatever you want.
And the more we get it out in the world, the more other people are sending me back their videos, and I'm just amazed at what people come up with and how beautiful it is and how unique it is and how, you know, because there's no rules. And you know, some people get it and they say, oh, well, clearly it needs to be played with a bow or, you know, with two sticks on either side or with my hands crossed. And so, I love that it's something that everyone gets to make, you know, their own thing out of.
A lot of people are performers are a little, you know, thrown on the back foot by everything that's happened in the last year, and they don't get to play as much. And when they do get to play, they play these virtual shows, And a number of people I've seen doing these virtual shows are really uncomfortable with them. But it seems to me that in some ways it's ideal for what you do, right?
Oh, absolutely not. It's horrible. I mean, the
Well, I mean, you know, I watched the Georgia Tech show and I thought, you know, the Georgia Tech show you did was brilliant, you know, and it was perfect for that medium, you know?
Well, you know what, though? We're talking about an interesting point. So, you know, it's one thing to turn your phone on and, you know, go live and play. Mm. It's another thing to, you know, I travel to a venue with safety precautions. I socially distance from all crew and all camera people, but that was that was edited. Mm. So you were not watching a live show. You were watching a show that I, yes, performed live. It's been, the lighting was perfect and the sound was great. Everything was very carefully edited. And if you had watched the whole thing unedited through a crappy camera system, you know, like what I'm saying is it took an enormous amount of energy for that live stream to be kind of palatable. And it took it took the resources of a massive technical college. Certainly not, you know, I wasn't paying for that production. And I'm grateful for Georgia Tech, but it really, it was an example as to what it still takes to have to get people to be fundamentally interested.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, I guess, you know, it was heartening in that we did it and we pulled it off and I had the support and I'm so grateful to Georgia Tech for that. But it's also disheartening in that it really did take that much, you know, talent off stage and, you know, from the stagehand to the sound and lighting design to the, you know, the camera operators and video editors, you know, it took a lot. And that's really not what, you know, the average person gets to, the average musician is going to be able to afford to do on a monthly basis.
Yeah, and well, putting aside the fact that the concept by itself is something that nobody has thought of before. I mean, I grew up with light shows, you know, but this is like a light show on the guitar directly.
Well, yes, that's true. Yeah,
which is really cool.
So we also had that aspect to it. Yes, thank you. That has been an exploration that I've been doing for quite a while. This light show happened to be the guitar was being tracked using some VR technology as opposed to it being fixed like I had it in the past. And with, you know, interesting results. we would have had more time to work out some bugs if we had been touring and being in venues regularly. But you know what? Hey, like I'll just be grateful that even happened. And, but it is a testament to just how challenging it is to keep people interested, and how many times I've logged into a show and seen, you know, I'm watching a band or an artist that I'm really a huge admirer of that I feel like there's a lot of fans and they're playing to foreign people. And I'm like, wow, okay, yep, that's where we are right now.
Hmm. I'm listening to what you're saying and what I'm getting as a kind of subtext is performance is not your first consideration. And that was all about creating an ideal performance, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, what is performance, though? It was a pre-record, you know? It was there was a net beneath me. I had plenty of room to fall, and I had almost no risk, which to me is not, it's much harder for that to be productive. For instance, because of that, and I knew that there wasn't a, you know, I was busy with, you know, all kinds of other things, and so the traveling down to Georgia Tech to do this, you know, we did rehearse a little bit in advance, but my playing simply was not what it was. And not just because I don't have regular shows happening, but also because when I played in my little home studio, it was fine. It was acceptable. It was okay. You know, like, sure, that song sounds like that song. And when I got to the venue and I'm actually playing it as I would in a performance, really digging in, really feeling everything, my muscles were almost giving out. Like, I'm out of shape. I'm rusty. So it was a teaching moment for me, because I realized, wow, I not only can I not rest on, you know, some idea that I still can hack it, it's not enough to just be playing at home for me. Like, the player that I am is coming from someone that has toured almost monthly for 2 decades. And I simply am not going to be able to just, you know, go through the songs and make sure I know the structure and then go on stage. So I learned that lesson the hard way. I had to retake some of those songs because I just crashed and burned.
Yeah, that never occurred to me, but I can completely understand that. The other point you made, which I think is kind of interesting because I've had some measure of that same experience. I don't know. The interesting thing about, it seems to me, about the point that we're at collectively is that while we are distanced physically from one another, there's a connection with one another that I haven't felt in quite the same way before.
Oh, well, that's very... That is... That makes me feel hopeful. I miss humanity on a level that I can't really quite describe. It's so profound. And I think that the fact that my way of connecting to people... And the fact that it, you know, it's my job, and not only is it my job, it is definitely tied up with my ego and my self-identity and all of those things that, you know, shutting off that tap that flowed so abundantly, you know, all of a sudden I'm still in the adjustment period, and it has, you know, made me see some things about myself that I didn't really realize. For instance, like how much it was tied to my ego and how much it was tied to my self-identity and how much it was, you know, part of my life to just think, well, can't solve that problem and because, you know, I'm going to be on tour next week, so I'll just let that, you know, I'll kind of ignore that aspect.
Kaki King's most recent album is Modern Yesterdays. We'll have the second half of this conversation next week on Talking Writing. This is Scenic Roots on listener-supported public radio.